From Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. This week, we were thrilled to be able to chat with Greg Wise. Greg is an actor and producer who has starred in numerous films and TV programmes, Sense and Sensibility, Johnny English, The Crown, to name a few, but he is also a published author. Last year, he published Not That Kind of Love, a book that was co-produced with his sister, Claire Wise, which is all about her experience with cancer in the last 3 years of her life. Since that book was published, Greg has done a number of interviews that all have the same message: we need to talk more about death. I invited him along to do just that. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Afternoon. So, a pretty perfunctory Google of your name reveals that you talk about death and dying quite a lot.
I do.
More than most.
Yeah. It's my new gig now.
How did that happen?
I was my sister's full-time carer towards the end of her life. She died in September 2016 now, so 2.5 years ago. And for about the last 3 months of her life, she didn't want anyone around at all. And this is one of the things I think that we do need to talk about and explore: the shame of being very ill.
Right.
And the fact that I think a lot of us are very much designed and built around who we are in society and who we are with our embossed business cards and our company cars and our salary and the shoes we buy, or the place we are within a society in more general terms, or within a family as a breadwinner or the... And I think when this is snatched away from you and you have nothing to give you shape apart from the illness that you're suffering, it can, of course, do a myriad of different things to a myriad of different personalities. But in my sister's case, I think she felt shame about it. And she was a very protected person, a very emotionally protected person. And of course, it's very exposing being very ill.
Yeah.
Because you are prodded with and forced into various indignities over your treatments. And I had always been the go-to guy in her life. She'd never had a partner. She had a cat. She was a lady of a certain age with a cat.
I mean, I'm also a lady of a certain age with a cat.
So do you have a brother?
I do.
Okay. Be nice to him.
Okay.
and she started with breast cancer. I don't think she was ever in remission from that. It turned into bone cancer, which is horrible. And you don't get better from it. And the prognosis is generally less than 2 years from when the diagnosis comes. And there came a moment where she required someone to be there full time. And I was fantastically fortunate enough not to have a proper job and to have a very understanding family who let me just drop everything as a dad and a husband.
Did you have any doubts in whether or not you wanted to make that decision?
It was not a question I had to ask. I couldn't not have done it.
Yeah.
It was that simple. But I know I'm just fortunate that I could have done that. And I know a lot of people I talk to say, well, look, the way my life is, the way my work is structured, the way my family is structured, there's no way I could have done what you do. And I'm not saying that I should be any form of model for end-of-life care. But what I would say is that it is almost a complete balance of trauma and privilege looking after someone as they're dying.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand the privilege of it, I think, until later on.
Well, no. Trauma eclipses everything at the time.
Yeah. because it is in many ways unbearable. But what I'm interested in exploring now, and I'm doing a lot of reading and I'm talking to a lot of people, and I hope this will be the next book, is about the privilege of it and the growth that happens as a result of it. The post-traumatic growth, which is a very new thing that's being bandied around at the moment. But I think if you put yourself in a situation where you have no idea if you will be capable in any way, that you are having to be all things pretty much to the person you're looking after. And I've always known I was a very capable guy. I'm very good at problem solving. I'm good with my hands. I can make stuff. I'm a carpenter. I can do electrics and plumbing. And I worked on building sites and trained as an architect. And, you know, I do all that stuff. But the requirement emotionally alongside that, I wasn't sure I was able to do. And I did it. And I did it with as much grace as possible. And I was able to do that because my sister allowed me to do that.
Yeah.
Because there has to be as much grace from the other side.
Yeah.
As well. And kindness and compassion. Because it's not every sister who would allow her brother in his cheap underpants to take her into the shower on her commode and wash her.
Yeah, it's a relationship that often doesn't get that physical.
No,
siblings.
No,
you don't. And no. When it does, people don't talk about it that much.
Yeah.
I don't really know why.
Because it's somehow transgressive.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I know that we had a very particular relationship anyway, as a brother and sister, out of the ordinary relationship. But I know, as horrible as so much of that time was, that last few months of her life, the privilege of sharing that time with her and what we became as a couple was extraordinary. It really was. And I grieve my sister every day, but I'm thankful every day that we had that time together. And it was an extraordinary time that we spent, that very few people, I think, even very few married couples will ever find themselves in such a profound level of life.
Mm.
Because of course the dying process is the living process. It's all about life. It's just the last breath that stops the life bit and makes it about death. And I'm very grateful that I was able to have that experience.
Yeah.
With her.
Well, it's unusual as well, because care and dying is often takes place in other places than the home hospitals, hospices, care homes.
Yeah.
I think it's obviously, there are a huge number of carers who are doing unpaid work, but I think it is quite unusual for families to sort of witness the death for themselves in their own home.
Yeah. Again, great privilege that she was able to stay in her flat, that we had the most extraordinary hospice, local hospice care, the Marie Curie up in Hampstead, with the glorious Adrian Tookman, who runs the place. Who looks and sounds like a bin man, but is the most extraordinary palliative doctor.
I've not met him. I'll look
he
out
won't
that.
Mind me saying he looks and says, oh, it's like that. Come on, Greg. And they allowed me to keep my sister at home.
Yeah.
I think one of the only times I really got upset was I used to have to go once a week to pick up her meds, these banging opioids that we're all, of course, now very aware of with the Sackler family. And the mis-prescribing of OxyContins and OxyNorm. But when you're in that kind of pain, and the bone pain that nothing touches,
yeah,
she was on those drugs, and so I'd do my inventory on a Thursday and work out what we needed of the Efentoras and the other bits and pieces, and email it through and cycle up to the hospice on the Friday and pick it up. And generally, when I went up to pick the script up, I'd be taken into Adrian's office or the other doctor there, Faye Gishen, and they'd sit me down and ask me how I was.
They do that at hospice.
Which I found quite difficult to start with, because I said, it's not about me, it's about my sister, it's about Claire. They said, no, of course it's about you. How are you? And towards the end, and Adrian graciously saying, we can always find a bed for her, and I got really angry with him. Which he understood and took on the chin.
Because you knew she wouldn't want to.
No, I said, over my dead body.
Right.
Really. Because, of course, part of all of this discussion where we are now is about the appropriate place for someone to die. Mm-hmm. Because generally, as far as I'm aware from talking to folk and reading stuff, dying isn't medical. Dying's palliative.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, due to a myriad of pressures upon systems and families and resources, people die in medical institutions, which is bonkers. Hospitals are designed to get people better and to send them on their way. They're not designed as holding bays.
Yeah.
And that was very clear with my sister, that she had gone through the medicalization of her illness with the chemotherapies and the radiotherapies and the surgeries, but that had come to an end, and we were now just looking at pain control and quality of life, trying to balance those things. And why do that in a hospice?
Mm-hmm.
She loved the space that she lived in. She had her cat. She had all her stuff around her. And she had her brother at the end of a little bell push, a front doorbell remote thing. So she pressed the button and the bell rang wherever I was in the flat, would appear. And generally it was about hydration and about meds and about making sure she was, when she was able to eat, feeding properly. And extraordinarily, the moment she chose to die was the moment that there was going to have to be an outside force coming in now, because it was above my pay grade in what I was able to do.
Right.
She was already catheterized. That was fine. I was able to do that. We had an issue with a catheter one night, and you know, I could have gaffer taped it and done all the sort of DIY brother stuff, but we needed professionals around. And it was 3 months of me living there 24/7 with her. So we were both pretty exhausted.
Yeah.
And getting to the point where there was a requirement for a care plan to be put in place. And the day that the care plan was going to start, by having people visit and giving her bed baths. And
yeah, suddenly this whole like team of
the team with in. their plastic aprons and rubber gloves and a whole other thing. And that was the morning she chose to die.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy how often you hear about that happening,
mm-hmm.
about people choosing the moment when they want to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is often about privacy. That's something Catherine Manick said, mm-hmm. the amount of times mm-hmm. people will choose to wait until their family have left the room to
I've
go on and get a cup of tea.
Extraordinary
like
stories. A mate of mine's dad was sitting at her mum's bedside literally constantly, and was desperate for a poo.
Yeah.
Went off for a poo, and his wife died.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is that, or there is giving them the permission. And I did that with my sis. She was the last night was she sunk very deep into an unconscious state, and it was all very messy in the morning, and I realized quite how messy it was getting, and I just said to her, look, we've done really well, it's now just too messed up. I love you very much. I know you love me. You can go if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And within 90 seconds, she was dead.
I mean, yeah, that's almost frightening.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the power of the brain.
Yeah.
Her body had completely fallen apart weeks, if not months before. Our GP came round, who hadn't seen her for quite a while. I think about a week before she died. And couldn't believe she was still alive. But it's the power of the brain.
Yeah.
And that's still very much there when the body is completely wasted. And the brain, the person, the soul, however you want to call it, needs to get the permission, needs to be given the permission.
Yeah.
By someone able to give the permission and for that person to hear that permission given. And it was extraordinary. Literally, it was a minute and a half.
Later. Yeah. I mean, what did you do?
I sat with her, held her hand. She and I had both been with our mum at her death as well. And we'd had a very humorous few minutes afterwards because I went to test my mum's pulse and couldn't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
So I tested my pulse and couldn't feel it. I tested my sister's pulse and couldn't feel it. So we had a laugh, and, you know, in the end, because, of course, we knew about the stent breathing and the fact that sometimes it can be a minute and a half between breaths, and we're waiting for the breath.
Yeah.
I think eventually we got the mirror above the nose and mouth. And I had the same thing with Claire, with my sister. When she stopped breathing, I checked her pulse, and I started laughing, and I knew that she'd laugh as well. But it's very clear when someone's dead. It's very clear they've gone. They've completely gone.
Yeah.
And luckily, my wife and daughter, who'd been away, had just come back a few days earlier, so they were able to come down and be with my sister. And my daughter went off and picked flowers in the garden and put them by the bed, and we lit candles and made it a wonderful sacred space before the phone call started to the getting the death certificate and the funeral home round,
which is the awful bit, really, all the admin.
Yeah. I mean, I could write books about all the absolute nonsense that comes afterwards with data protection and getting incredibly aggressive letters for non-payment of council tax addressed to Claire Wise, deceased.
Wow, yeah.
What's just so ridiculous is some organisations are prepared for the people who have phone contracts with them to die mid-contract, or credit cards or whatever, and others aren't.
Yeah.
Some crowds you phone and say, hello, I'm phoning on behalf of, and they go, let me put you through to the bereavement crowd we have here. And you go, thank you very much. And they're all very lovely. Other crowds say, I need to speak to the account holder. I said, I've just explained she's dead. Well, I can't tell you anything. Okay. And that's...
Rock up with a Ouija board. Like,
yeah.
What do you want me to do?
That's messed up because you're, of course, in a fairly wobbly place at the time. And I had various phone calls with various people, and I just, as gently as possibly, said, can you please stop saying no? Can you find another way, please?
Yeah. I mean, even people who are supposed to get it right sometimes don't. Like, my grandmother died in a care home,
mm-hmm.
and was then, she is in Devon, so everything's miles away, shipped over to a funeral director's, but they hadn't certified the death, and it was too far away for the GP to come out of their sort of little catchment area. Yeah. So she had to be like bussed back.
Yeah.
GP came out of the door, was like,
She's dead.
She is in fact dead. Yeah, yeah. You may now go. My mum was furious because it was just this like undignified shepherding.
I know.
Of the body.
Well, the good thing is that they're not with us anymore.
Yeah.
It's just a, it's whatever's left over. They've left. They've gone. Yes, and of course, the indignity is more about us than about them.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But again, it's all about the fact that we do this so poorly. We do it ourselves on our journey to death. We do it as people looking after people. We do it afterwards. We don't do death well. We're not grown up about it. We're not. The various people I talked to after she died, I was saying, look, there must be hundreds of thousands of people who die during a Vodafone contract. What do you normally do? I mean, we had this with our dad. Again, you've got to laugh. I think it was Vodafone. He had a mobile phone with them, and we let them know that he was dead. And blah. And a couple of days later, we get a letter from them saying at the top, "We're sorry to see you go." And you phone them and say, "What's this?" "Oh, well, it's computer generated." This is another thing that people hide behind all the time: computer generated. Say, okay. You have to be better than this.
Yeah.
You have to be better than "Dear Claire Wise deceased. We're going to take you to court over the non-payment of whatever."
Yeah.
"And we're sorry to see you go" is the computer-generated letter when people cancel their contracts because they think they're going off to another phone provider rather than the great phone provider in the sky. We have to be better than this.
Yeah.
And we're not better than this because we're not able to talk about it as you and I are talking about it.
Yeah.
We're not able to talk about it as a family. We're not able to get our plans sorted out for how we want to approach life-limiting illness and then death. And my daughter, who's 19 now, is starting to get tattoos, which, you know, her dad hates. Mm-hmm. And I said, "The only tattoo I'm going to get is on my chest, DNR, and on my back, PTO.
Wow.
That's it. Again, having to do a DNR for my sister and having to put in the box within that, sitting with, I think, one of the Macmillan nurses, or I don't know who it was anyway, probably about a month before she died. I had to put a reason not to resuscitate. And I said cruelty. And the doctor says, "I don't know if that's enough of a reason." I said, "That's enough of a reason."
Yeah, I would think so.
Again, we have to be better at this. We have to be able to say it's cruel. And the more research I've done, it's only something, I think it's less than 20% of CPR works.
I think it's 10.
Is it 10?
I think so.
Less than 20%. Something like, 11% or whatever.
Yeah.
17%, something. Anyway, hardly anyone.
No.
It hardly works on anyone. You generally get broken bones.
Yeah, people don't know what it actually looks like.
This is the thing. They think
is.
CPR means that if I'm flatlining, these extraordinary angelic figures will come in and bring me back to life.
Yeah, Grey's Anatomy kind of thing.
It's brutal. And it's brutal for these poor people who come into a space and are desperate to find a do not resuscitate thing somewhere to hand. Because, again, we've got to be better. We've got to be able to have a database about all of this stuff. I know there's little ones around for the London area, but as we say, if your gran had had all her, however you want to put it, because I know there's different systems around your wishes, your wishes, do not resuscitate, DNCPR, all of this stuff, then goes on holiday to Cornwall, has a heart attack there or whatever, and they can't access that.
Yeah.
So they are actually going against the wishes of your grandmother just because she's left this particular postcode. That is insane.
Yeah.
Again, it's about us being better at talking to each other.
Especially because we know we live in a world where that's completely possible, where these kinds of
but
systems
that's the
exist.
Thing. I mean, I don't quite understand why it's so difficult for there to be joined up governance within a health service.
Yeah.
But there is. There obviously is, because we've seen Siemens and Marconi and whoever else spending tens of millions of pounds and systems crashing. We've all got, I mean, most of us have got a smartphone. In most places, you're going to get a signal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know where I spend a lot of my year. We don't have a signal. And I leave my smartphone in a drawer. But generally, it's not rocket science, really.
Yeah.
And I think it is cruel a lot of the time. If you've actually bothered to sort out your wishes.
Which is a hard thing to make yourself do.
Yeah. But I'm trying now to get people to talk about this as much as they talk about birth.
Yeah.
And the run up to birth and all the classes you do and all the social media noise.
Mm-hmm.
Pre, during and post birth. We have to be able to do that. Because it's Catherine, beautiful Catherine Mannix. The thing that I remember vividly in her book, which I bandy around all the time. We only have 2 days in our lives that are under 24 hours. The day we were born and the day we die.
Yeah.
That puts things in beautiful perspective.
Uh-huh.
And all the time, all the noise about that first day and the utter denial.
Yeah.
About the second.
Yeah.
And it's just bringing that conversation back into a Sunday lunch.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Because there is
before you're ill.
Yeah. And there is a big death positive movement happening. There are talks happening all over the place, panels and podcasts and whatever, but it is still seemingly very hard for it to happen in everyday life.
When I was in America, I saw it in a online newspaper. Is it a pop-up shop in Lewisham Shopping Centre?
Yeah, Departure Lounge.
Isn't that fantastic? Of course, people go in thinking it's a luggage shop.
Yeah,
and then go, hang on, what's all this about? And of course, some people freak out and walk away, and some people go, I'd never thought of this. How interesting. That's what we got to do. I went to two, 3 years ago, I think it was, the South Bank did a weekend death and dying festival, and they had various coffins around and paints nearby and kids painting coffins. And there were talks by doulas and everything else. Which is great, but that's the South Bank, London. We've got to get it out everywhere. We've got to have it permeate everyone's lives. I'm suggesting that we have it as part of the, is it PSHE at school?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the things that if we don't understand something, if we can't see something, we're scared of it.
Yeah.
The most powerful bits of theatre happen off stage and someone comes and tells us about it. That's where the word obscene comes from. Obscene means off stage. Obscena, not on the stage. Something is too obscene to be seen, so someone has to come and tell us about it. And also, of course, always someone telling us. We then use our imaginations.
Yeah.
If something is then brought out into the sunlight, slap bang in the middle of the stage, and we can witness it, it takes away all the fear of it. And that's what we have to do about death, because death is shadowy. And we hear about it third person.
Yeah.
Because very few people have witnessed it.
Which means that we find it difficult to deal with it, like actual human beings who can relate to each other. Like the automatic computers, there's no attitude on the end of the phone.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, because we are all humans. And it's the one thing that we like all have in common.
Yeah, and I'm not saying everyone, as part of their education at school, needs to go and sit with a person until they're dead.
Some people do think that.
But I think we have to have people like me who've sat with people until they've died who aren't health professionals.
Yeah.
You know, Catherine Mannix is extraordinary. She said, I think it's about 15,000 people I've been part of the dying. Again, she's so fantastic to have around, because she says, I think in less than a dozen of those cases, I wanted to intervene. Because everyone thinks death is painful.
Yeah.
And she's seen thousands upon thousands upon thousands of deaths. and if a handful she wanted to go in and do something about, that's not bad.
No.
Like she said, honestly, the births that she's witnessed are far more violent than any death she's ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And people don't know that it can be a peaceful thing.
Yeah. That it generally is a peaceful thing.
Yeah.
And I was with my mum when she died. I was with my sister when she died. My father, because he was that type of person, waited until, because I was with him for his last few months of life as well. Oddly. But he waited until I just landed in Egypt on a week's holiday before he died.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get back from there was a laugh. That's taking things to extremes, but I think to have people bearing witness about it and about the privilege of it as well, there's something, you know, like in the old Greek, the Naiad or whatever, people coming back from Hades.
Yeah.
And telling you about it. I think there's something that kind of metaphorical about the journey that you go on with someone when they're dying.
Mm.
And you're shadowing.
Well, and people visit the underworld all the time as well. You're so much closer and you witness it. You're sort of at the gates.
Yeah, and you come in and you take the fear out of it.
Yeah.
We are all going to die. I think one of the things that surely has to be the start of any conversation is, well, how would you want to die?
Yeah.
How would you, would you want to die on your own in a hospital? No. Okay. So how would you want to die? All right. Let's spool back from there to where we are now and see how we can get to that point as gracefully as possible.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And let's talk to your mate about it and your sister-in-law. And your daughter, and a guy you've just met in the pub. You know, all of this stuff. We like the phone calls I had where they scream data protection. People scream morbid.
Yeah, they do.
It's not morbid. It's not morbid. It's no less morbid than talking about birth.
No. No. And birth's arguably a lot more dangerous anyway.
Yeah, and as Catherine says, and then people repeat it. They have more babies. They know.
Yeah, then they do it
know
again.
How exquisitely painful and traumatic it's going to be.
Yeah.
But they've got this fantastic.
But I think there is still a couching of the truth in birth as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we don't go into the, and then, you know, my intestines were laid bare for the cesarean kind of thing. Yeah. We talk about the wonder and
of course,
the beauty of,
because there's
the
something extraordinary that comes from it.
Yeah.
I would suggest there is something as extraordinary that comes from doing death properly, is a good death. We just have to keep asking ourselves, how would I want to die? That's all. Because we are all going to die. I'm so sorry to tell you.
Do you know how you want to die?
I've very much changed my mind with having, I think not only with my sister, but both my parents, my mother especially, I spent quite a long time with her, running up to her death. I was always of the mind that if I got terminal news, I would take myself up into the hills with a bottle of whiskey. And do the hypothermic exit.
I think a lot of people feel like that.
And I won't do that now, because it's not fair on the people I leave behind.
Yeah.
There is something, as I've been talking about throughout this, of the privilege of being with someone dying. And you've got to also be pragmatic about it. We are not going to beautifully finish our relationship. There's not going to be some wonderful moment. That only happens in novels.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen in life. Life's messy. Don't expect that. But people you love, who love you, want to be a part of it.
You sound like you were uniquely prepared in a way.
I wasn't uniquely prepared for anything. I was fortunate that I'm self-employed. That actually the reason I spent the few months with my dad before he died was, oddly, I got a filming job 20 miles away from where he lived in the Northumbrian countryside. So I just, rather than staying in a hotel nearby, I just stayed at what had been our cottage when I was a kid, which was the house that he lived in till he died.
Right.
It wasn't planned at all. I just happened to have that. And I was filming up there on and off. So most of the time I was hanging with him, and he was very clear about, right, this needs to go to the tip. That needs to go to charity. You need to keep hold of that. He'd written down all the, because he was a professor of architecture, but all the rest of his family were fine artists. So he had an amazing amount of art from family members and friends and stuff in the house. Everything was annotated. This is who it's by. This is how I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Put stickers on the back. You can pass that on. Keep hold of this. This is really important.
That's amazing.
sorted out the finances. Really, and that month or so with him, it was banging back and forth to the tip with stuff, going back and forth to various charity shops, and just hanging with him.
Yeah.
And talking. And he didn't want to go anywhere emotional, which I knew, so I wasn't expecting anything emotional. My sister wanted some sort of rounding of their lives together. And I said, you're not going to get this, mate, ever. And of course, as she was dying, she didn't want to go anywhere near that either.
Mm.
Didn't want to talk about any of that kind of stuff. And I didn't expect anything.
You know, I mean, reading the book, I think both of you did a thing in your writing styles where you would sort of apologize for veering anywhere near anything emotional.
Yeah.
Say, oh, sorry, that was a bit morbid.
Well, yeah.
Or not morbid,
no,
sorry.
No, but she, that was how she lived. She was unwilling to go there. And thus she was unwilling to go there in her writing. Because people die how they live.
Yeah.
My dad was a professor. He was very stoic. He would talk about the weather in the garden, and that was how he shuffled off. My mum, Eastern European, feisty, angry. That's how she died.
Mm-hmm.
My sister, in total denial about so many things, not wanting anything emotional coming in that she wasn't able to bat away. That's how she died. When I took over the writing of the blog, because this book started as a blog, it was to keep everyone at arm's length, to say, this is what's going on medically.
Yeah.
This is how we're doing. It's all fine. Please leave us alone.
Yeah.
And then the more time I spent there, because of both the weight of the cancer and the weight of the opioids, my cyst was probably only an hour and a half, 2 hours, actually sentient and able to hold a conversation. So the rest of the time, I was in this space on my own.
Yeah.
Waiting for her to ring the bell. So, of course, you start to think about where you are and where she is and what life's all about. And you start to wax about that. And every blog post I did was real-time writing. 8 o'clock at night when I'd given her last meds and she was sleeping, and I'd just sit and I'd just write. And I wanted people to know what was going on, but also protecting them about what was actually happening.
Yeah.
And then I got to the point where I thought, who am I to protect anyone? It was written for family and friends. We were getting tens of thousands of people reading it that I didn't know. All over the world, didn't know who they were. And I thought, well, who am I to protect anyone? So I started to be more honest about what was happening. Because Claire was, I don't think, ever honest. She would be honest about procedures, and she'd be honest about hair loss and what happens to your nails and all of that.
Well, I think she was very funny and self-deprecating about certain vulnerabilities and insecurities and weight and stuff like
but
that.
But emotionally honest about where she actually was.
Right.
Because that wasn't her. That's not what she did. That's, we'd never had that kind of conversation. So why would she do that in a piece of writing? And I think I found it a sort of catharsis to be able to be as emotionally honest as I was able to be, especially towards the very end. And after she died, but I was a lunatic at that stage. I was mad, really. I don't think I could have carried on for very much longer as her 24/7 carer.
Mm-hmm.
And I am in absolute awe of people who do this for years and years and years. I know I couldn't. It's an extraordinary thing, and I know, having talked to a lot of organizations and people, we have 7 million carers, 1 in 10 of us in this country are now carers. If everyone were paid, that is the entire budget of the NHS again.
Mm-hmm.
This is an extraordinary army of people. It's kids who are missing school, it's siblings, it's kids looking after their parents, it's parents looking after their kids. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Different scenarios the entire time, held together by this amazing care that we're able to do. And it nearly bloody killed me.
Yeah.
It really did. I don't know. It's like when you're a parent to a newborn. Yeah, I don't know how anyone does it. We all did it. We were all mad and sleep deprived and angry.
Yeah.
Resentful.
Times.
Yeah. And of course you never tell that to any new parent either. But I think it's possibly a similar thing for carers, but then as your child gets older, all the kit that you have to have at the start starts to dwindle. It's the exact inverse when someone gets more and more ill, because mm-hmm. the kit starts to build up.
Yeah. Beds and apparatus.
So the pushchair, the wheelchair, the baby bath is the little machine that you put in to raise and lower them from the occupational therapy lot. It is an absolute, it's a blissful mirroring of the gear,
mm-hmm.
which is why we should talk about it in the same way, which is why we need to talk about death the same way as we talk about birth.
Yeah. And was that when you decided to publish the blog as a book?
No. I wrote it for itself at the time.
Yeah.
And it became then more about me writing it for me as a catharsis, and just as a voice in a space where I was voiceless, and was very clear that it had to end. After her death, telling everyone how she died and what happened, and then saying about the funeral and what we'd organized and the funeral itself. And then we had a memorial for my sister on her birthday, what would have been her 52nd birthday, I think, where we had a banging disco night. And that was the last posting I did for the people who weren't able to come to write about that. And so that's it. It's all finished. And that was it. That was it. That was it. That was all it was going to be. And then I had a literary agent approach me and say, "This really should be a book."
Right.
And 5 different publishers were interested in it, and I went and met all of them to hear what they had to think about it. And I said, "This can't be edited. This was written real time."
Yeah.
Not knowing what's going on. And it has to be published that way. And ended up with the wonderful publishers who acquiesced to that. And We tidied up a bit of the grammar.
Mm-hmm.
And I took out a couple of lines that Claire had written because she was angry. She was being a bit cruel about her mate. And I took that out because I thought we don't need that in.
Yeah.
But that was all.
Do you think she'd be happy or pleased?
Yeah, she's a published author.
Yeah.
Absolutely. but again, it would because otherwise it would become a little bit about vanity. And the moment I was most frustrated and not angry, but just frustrated and tired and grumpy with my sister. The grumpiest I was the post I put out the night before she died.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know she was going to die. And were we to edit it, I'd have taken that out and been all lovey-dovey and gooey. And no, I was really, really, really pissed off with everything and grumpy with her. And the very next piece of writing, the very next page was Claire died at 8 o'clock yesterday morning. You've got to keep all that in. We never know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen. So we can't selectively edit to make us look nicer human beings.
Yeah, and it's that brings comfort to people who are reading it, because that's what mirrors real life, as opposed to the soap opera last words kind of thing.
No, completely, because no one has last words.
No.
And it's messy, because life's messy. This is just life. This is life we're looking at. It just happens to be the end bit.
Yeah.
It's not death. And I'm certain that people die how they live.
Mm-hmm.
No one has this great changing moment, suddenly becoming all
free and
light. Well, free and angelic about it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're an angry, resentful person, you will die in an angry and resentful way.
Uh-huh.
If you're fairly hippie and you'll toodle off in that way.
Find a tree.
Yeah. I don't think anyone, unless they do the work, unless they read the books and try and do it properly, I don't think anyone changes at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why we have to have these conversations
mm-hmm.
while we're all healthy.
So would you say that's your mission now?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally. I mean, I've done a fair chunk of stuff in the last couple of years of book festivals and talking to people and doing podcasts. And it's essential. And I think I'm maybe even right at the very start when I did a book launch at a bookshop in North London at Waterstones. An editor from Faber, who I knew, contacted me afterwards and said, I've come to launches for 30 years. I've never been in one like that. She said it was more like a political rally.
Wow.
Because I don't sit and read stuff. I, you know, just talk and la-la and extemporise. And I think I'm able to talk reasonably coherently about it all.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important to do that. And I'm hopefully shortly embarking upon writing a book as a sort of follow-up to this, just exploring it a little bit more. Possibly as a guide, as a roadmap, as something, as a series of suggestions of things that could be worth thinking about. Because I've talked to so many extraordinary people, I want to bring their ideas into it. There are systems in place, if you know where to find them, but mm-hmm. people don't know.
No.
I am proof that it is possible to have gone into this fantastically dark space and come out a better person for it. And I use better in inverted commas because it's, you know, it's this pejorative word, but it's if one is able to do whatever one is able to do to help somebody die, it helps the grief. And I know, talking to people who have not been able to be either present during the time of dying or present at a death because of work, family, whatever it might be, grief is pure. Grief is natural. It's healthy. Shame and guilt get in the way.
Yeah.
And that's what really messes the purity of the grief. And it messes up one's relationship with oneself and thus with the person that has died. And so many folk cannot forgive themselves for having gone to that meeting.
Yeah.
Well, no one knows when someone's going to die. We have a reasonable idea. But it's not going, you know, you're not going to know it's going to be between 2:30 and 3:45 on Wednesday. And it's that kills people.
Yeah.
It's the grief, it's the shame and the guilt mixed in with the grief. Grief is great because the universe is balanced. The love you feel equals the grief you feel. The more grief-stricken you are, the more profound the relationship was, and the more this person is invested in you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. The relationship doesn't end. It just takes on a different
shape. Yeah, and that's a really beautiful way of looking at
it. It doesn't end. It doesn't end at all. The conversation becomes slightly more one-sided. That's all. It's when these other things come into play. It's when you have that grief, that the guilt and the shame with it, or that's toxic. That becomes toxic. And we don't need to have that if we're able to have the conversations and to be honest with each other.
Being honest with the ones we love is hard, especially when it's about death. But I think Greg makes a great case for why it's so important. We're really grateful to Greg for taking the time out to chat with us. You can read his and Claire's story in full in their book, Not That Kind of Love. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with another episode next week.